This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org.
All right. Folks, this is Dr. Doug Lyle, and I am here, and Nate G. has asked me to do this intro because he's setting something up at his magnificent facility where he does what we call the fasting escape. And for some reason, he needs me to be talking, and I'm not used to be talking.
All right, I'm back, Dr. Lyle.
So are you there?
I'm there, yeah. Thank you very much. Good evening, everybody. I was setting up the so at the fasting escape here as one of the activities. We don't really have that many activities, but one of them is I broadcast this show to the TV in the main room so that guests can, you know, enjoy it, experience it. And then what's really cool is afterwards, usually they get into a discussion about what you talked about. Because for some of the guests, it's brand new experience. They've never heard this. They've heard you talk about evolutionary psychology in the context of health and healthful living, which is really incredibly useful. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot more to it, and it has to do with health and happiness as well. So without further ado.
All right. Sure.
All right. So today we've got some questions from our listeners. And Dr. Lyle, I had heard a topic a long time ago. It was like a book I kind of read a few pages of. It was all about this concept of radical honesty. And I'm probably paraphrasing it incorrectly, but the gist of what I got is that you really don't hide too much of what you're thinking. You just be radically honest with the situation. And, you know, I was never that into it. Tried it a little bit, ended up offending a lot of people, and just ultimately decided that maybe that's not the right move for me. But this first question from our listener has to do with radical honesty. Dr. Lyle, what's the best way to use all of this evolutionary psychology knowledge about man-woman dynamics in relationships? Listener is usually a big fan of the radical honesty approach, but sometimes it might be inappropriate to say, for example, oh, you're just jealous because your Stone Age brain feels over-rewarded with the situation. Dr. Lyle, I can be empathetic and weasel my way around it, but as many behaviors of me and people make so much sense, and so many people are skeptical towards evolutionary psychology, I don't want to get into a huge discussion about nature versus nurture every single time. But if I don't share that knowledge, I'll end up with a I understand all your behaviors mindset and hope and unfortunately become arrogant. Maybe yet I bought David Buss's textbook just so I can learn more, so I can convince people. Maybe yet another fear of status loss by losing a discussion. It's a fight in my own brain between share it so they understand themselves better, or let's make the best out of it and find a solution when I feel like a condescending know-it-all. Put differently, how do you not become arrogant with all of this profound knowledge?
An interesting question. There's something being raised in here. I don't quite feel like I have a full handle on what their question is, but we can try. Let's see. We have a desire to bring new information to the village in order to enhance our own esteem. So this kind of knowledge certainly is exciting and radical enough that it would confer upon the person bringing it added esteem to their village. So you would be motivated to bring this information just as you would be motivated to bring health information. If it turns out that you found out that, I don't know, ginseng and arrowroot combined together would get rid of lung cancer, then if you really found out that, if you were convinced that that was the case, then you would be very excited about bringing that information to the village and wanting full credit for bringing it. Now, so that's one motivation for bringing information to the village. A second reason for bringing information to the village is to not only benefit the listeners, i.e., and therefore benefit yourself indirectly by having gotten the appropriate status for bringing the information, but actually also to potentially turn those people into more effective people. So this information has the possibility of improving the thinking of the person on the other side of it. So it doesn't just benefit them, i.e. the way the ginseng arrowroot cure for their lung cancer, but in fact, making them more effective engines of problem solving in the human dynamics realm, and therefore aiding me. So if I've got five friends and I have discovered that there are limits let me sort of give you a great example of a problem that is now once again reawakened in the world as of last night, which is the NBA. So NBA basketball is in some ways unique among sports, and that's because in football, everybody's roles are very well defined, and the showing off is at a total minimum. In fact, in football, the showing off pretty well is limited to grandstanding after you make a play, and the NFL gets upset if a guy grandstands too much, and then they fine him or whatever. But you aren't influencing your team's success by your grandstanding, other than the sort of artificial issue of the, you know, of the referee's flag and the fines or whatever. And soccer, baseball, to maybe some degree, if you are swinging for the fences too much, you are wasting at bats. You're not optimal. There's a little bit of potential in baseball for making decisions that are not in the best interest of the team, but might be in your best interest, showing off your big muscles if you hit a home run. Not so much though. That's not a big issue in baseball. This is soccer, hockey. These are not particular issues. The big issues in basketball, and basketball is unique. You've got five guys on the court and one ball, and there is absolutely more status conferred upon the person that makes the shot, the other four guys who are on the same team and watch the shot go in. And so this means that, and of course, there's more money paid to the people that can score more efficiently. Now, so therefore, it's going to turn out that there is, of course, they have a goal together, which is to collectively win. But the truth of the matter is, even if a team loses and four players have a mediocre game, but one guy has a great game and scores a bunch of points, that guy's going to feel pretty good afterwards. Now, he'll make all the right noises, like, "Wow, I just played a win, and you know, it doesn't matter. We win as a team and lose as a team, blah, blah, blah." But that's not what it shows up in the newspaper. And that's not what everybody's talking about. Everybody's talking about how many points the one guy got and how great he played and how everybody else played lousy. So because people's the individuals involved, their survival and reproductive benefits to be had from the game, particularly reproductive benefits. In this case, this is it is rife for grandstanding. And as a result, coaching an NBA team has got to be one of the most difficult psychological tasks that anybody ever tried to take on, because of this tremendous dynamic tension between what's in the best interest of the team and what's in my personal best interest are usually different things. So God knows where I went with this and how I got off track. So the issue is that you've got, with respect to this knowledge, a value is that as you educate your coalition, it's actually in your best interest to educate your coalition, because then your coalition become more effective humans and help you. Okay, so there's that aspect to it. The other side of the dynamic is, if you're educating the coalition, you're getting a bunch of status, or you're attempting to earn a bunch of status, so there's going to be resistance. So there's going to be essentially a cost-benefit analysis that are going to be running inside of every brain that you come into as you attempt to expose people to this information. But so it's going to turn out that you can learn a lot about where the other person is at with respect to how well rewarded or not rewarded they feel in that coalition, their relationship to you, how it is that they, you know, what agreements they believe are in place in the coalition for the management of conflicts of interest between individuals, and whether evolutionary psychology and its prescriptions start to slaughter those agreements with insight. And so we're going to find out that each individual, as they listen to these ideas, is going to have a potentially fairly different reaction. Some individuals are going to feel like it's the devil talking. In other words, you're coming after tremendously sacred cows for them. If I were, for example, a far leftist Marxist, kind of an individual, and I don't know, I was a professor at Berkeley or somewhere like that, evolutionary psychology would be very disturbing, because, you know, I'm sort of raised on the notion that the reason there's differential outcomes between people is that things have been unfair and institutionally unfair, and some individuals have gotten the short end of the stick and blah, blah, blah. So all this kind of ridiculous nonsense. And so let's just say it's pretty ridiculous nonsense. There's a little bit of truth in it. There's 5% of the variance or 10% of the variance is involved, but it's not 100% of the variance. And the vast majority of outcomes for individuals in the United States, in this free country, have to do with the contributions that those people have made or are able to make in their trade relationships with others, including how beautiful they are, i.e., what contribution that can they make to the other person on the other sides of its reproductive goals, i.e. sexual excitement, i.e. the more attractive you are, the more valuable you are, plain and simple, okay? The smarter you are, the more valuable you are. The more conscientious and diligent you are, the more valuable you are. The more emotionally stable, the more valuable you are, et cetera, et cetera. It's going to turn out that people obviously differ tremendously in how valuable they might be, and therefore that different value that they have to the reproductive and survival goals of others goes a huge long ways in explaining the differential outcomes that people experience in life. This would bother a leftist, and it goes after their thinking with a hatchet. And so you can expect that they're going to, their cost-benefit analysis, as they think about where they stand in the world's coalitions, how it is that they're paid, who they're trying to get laid by, et cetera, everything about evolutionary psychology is like a voracious wolf ready to tear their thinking to shreds. And as a result, they're going to be extremely defensive about this. That would just be one set of people. I was married to a very, very fine psychologist, really sweet person, very smart person, very well-educated person, and an extremely well-meaning person. But the nature of evolutionary psychology's, 50,000-watt halogen lamp aimed at man-woman dynamics, of which we were a couple of young people trying to navigate those conflicts of interest, that was extremely uncomfortable for her. And as a result, I mean, that not as a result, but as a, you know, we parted ways because it was the right thing to do, and very amicably. However, she never became educated. So if you can imagine this extremely intelligent, extremely capable individual, was literally in at the ground floor at Clinical Evolutionary Psychology with me every day for years and never listened. Okay. So let's look at that. Okay. And I didn't particularly push it. I would just keep chirping up and chirping up, perfectly pleasant about it. But I watched this extraordinary defensiveness, of which you can sniff what's on the other side of it now, more clearly to me, more formally. The notion is, she was attempting to essentially vote down the fact that such discussions were legitimate, and we're going to try to push them to the side and ignore their validity because they were shedding light on the very conflicts that we were having. This is very much akin to the way our far left professor doesn't want to hear anything about behavior genetics. So remember that a reason itself is limited, that the motivation to seek the truth is itself not some independent floating entity out there that guides human mental action. The truth of the matter is that the reasoning process itself is guided by cost-benefit analytics, and that people believe in all kinds of crazy things and literally do believe in all kinds of crazy things because their nervous system can sniff that it's in their best interest to believe in crazy things. Now, this is well described by Sam Harris in The Moral Landscape about how people can be, because their minds are made up of independent neural circuits, they can have neural circuits that know the kind of they don't want to know. Okay. So to some
so
of
you're
us,
saying they can actually, people can actually see, almost not consciously, but subconsciously see into the future, not in the future, but that they're going to have to rethink so many assumptions that it's not worth it to spend that energy.
Actually, I would not say it was the energy. It's the point is that there's going to be some cataclysmic changes in status, and they're going to lose some.
Hmm.
Okay, so they can smell that. Like if you're the far leftist Berkeley professor, and I come sitting down and I sit down with you, with the information that indicates beyond any shadow of any doubt that individual differences in people are genetic. And that, in fact, there is incredibly good correlation coefficient between what people actually contribute and what it is that they get paid. Okay? And that, in fact, the economy is essentially not sexist and it is not racist. Okay? And if we go down through and we say, well, you know, women don't only make 60% of what men make. It's like, yeah, well, did you control for how many hours they worked? No, we didn't do that. Okay? Did you control for how unpleasant the activity was? No, we didn't do that. Okay. Did we control for how many years the person is on the job? No, we didn't do that. Did we control for what the person studied in school and what their degrees are? No, we didn't do that. Okay. So you didn't control for what the people are doing, how long they've been doing it, how often they do it. And yet we're going to say that women only make 60% of what men make. Well, by the time we control for all relevant variables, we'll find out that women are making just as much money as men are making, okay, as we would expect. Because if that were not the case, for example, what would happen is that a brilliant entrepreneur would simply hire all women for their staff, and they would pay them 90 cents on the dollar, and they would completely undermine their competition by being able to sell their product for 95% of what their competitor was selling the product for, scrape up the extra excess profits as a result of only paying the women 90 cents on the dollar what the men were being paid, and absolutely put the sword to their competitors' throat in the marketplace. This is obvious. That's exactly what would take place. Okay? And so as a result, that any concept of the free market being biased in such a way against a race or a gender is absurd. Okay, the free market is inherently greedy. You have to understand invisible hand phenomena. An invisible hand phenomena will absolutely drive wages, except where it's institutionally haywire, where we have guilds that are set up, but guilds are not set up along racist and sexist lines. Okay, so guilds are set up that, you know, you become a medical doctor, you become a psychologist, now our fees are set higher than the free market would have ever set them. That's a whole different issue. Now, so the point is that if I sat down with that stack of evidence and sat down with that logic and started pounding it through that professor's brain, there would be a cost-benefit analytics that brain would start to see that all the books and articles that they had published, and in fact all the lectures that they've given, and in fact all the people to whom they are heroes and that they're trying to get laid or get adulation from, they're going to lose it all. So they're going to run a cost-benefit, and they're going to say, get thee behind thee, Satan. Okay? I don't want to hear it. Okay? And that's the reaction that we're going to hear. So this is a wonderful question that the person asks. We're not coming at people trying to be know-it-alls. The people on the other side, we're wanting to get some status or some esteem for the information that we're bringing. This is truth. We have multiple agendas. Number one, we're bringing information that we consider valuable that might be valuable for them for God knows whatever reason. Whenever there is a major mistake in how it is that people view reality, that's fantastic to discover because there's no telling what distortions of behavior have been resultant from these errors. And therefore, there's profit in this. We just don't know what the profit is. Now, along the way, there's going to be some costs. Okay, this is just like if the government decides that we're going to build a bunch of pyramids out in the Mojave Desert. We're going to get people employed. And we do this, and it's going to turn out it's going to create distortions in the marketplace as there's going to be too much money going into developing quarries, for goodness sakes. Okay, so when we finally have to stop the absurd project, we've got economic dislocation that is partially tragic because it turns out that a bunch of people who've trained to work the stuff at quarries are now going to be unemployed, and they've spent time getting education on how to run quarry equipment that we don't need people to know have that information. So as a result, there's a transition between what people, you know, should have been doing and what they have been doing, and in there there's a crisis and costs that have to be finally paid as people move on and the economy becomes undistorted as we get rid of this fiasco. The same thing is true when people hold information that's incorrect. Okay, they hold information correct about a lot of things. So the person has had an incorrect thinking that hamburger, French fries, and a Coke are a perfectly balanced meal. That has, by the way, been published many times that this is true, that there's all these good things in the cheese that's on your burger, and the burger is a good thing because of the protein, and the et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So when I was a kid, this was actually touted, you know, by Walter Cronkite, for goodness sake, on the CBS Evening News that, you know, this some nutritionist or scientist said that this was true. So of course there's misinformation out there. And when it turns out that we discover that information, misinformation, and we become, it becomes clear to us that we have been going down a wrong track, it can be true that there can be some substantial hassles, and not to mention some status losses that have to come about as a result of us getting our heads corrected. Okay? So, oh my God, I just ran with this thing. I don't even know where we were going.
Well, it's also about the radical honesty. Like if someone's sharing something with you, they've never heard evolutionary psychology, and you say, oh, you're just over rewarded because your boyfriend or girlfriend is way more fancy than you are, so that's why you're getting jealous. You know?
Thank goodness somebody's paying attention to what was actually asked. Okay. The radical honesty, first of all, pretty silly. Actually, amazingly enough, Harry Brown was an advocate of that. I don't think they had that name, but I think in How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World, which is one of my very favorite books of all time, he talks about sort of this strategy, and he tries to make the case for where it is that, you know, why it is that this would be a good thing. I read it. I thought about it for about 15 minutes, and then I thought, absolutely ridiculous. The truth of the matter is that there's all kinds of situations where it's in your best interest to keep the information to yourself. And there's all kinds of situations where it's in your best interest to deceive people. Okay. And for multitudes of reasons, and an awful lot of them are unmistakably good reasons. So, good reasons, meaning everybody benefits by us keeping a deception in place. So so of course that's ridiculous. So if we're running into trouble, all I can say is this: when you have bring new information to the village, if that information has the possibility, in some cases, of being very disturbing for the people that are hearing it. Sometimes it's not going to be disturbing at all. Sometimes it will be very disturbing. It depends upon what the consequences are for this information. In my ex-wife's judgment, and in the judgment of much of the prescription for human man woman dynamics, it's supposed to look like this. It's supposed to look like once a little pair bond comes together, that nobody's ever supposed to look at anybody else, think about anybody else sexually, consider possibly defecting to a new relationship if a new relationship would become considerably more interesting, or that the existing relationship would not be very interesting anymore, et cetera. Okay, that the concept that that a relationship might be good for 6 months and not be good for 60 years will strike many people as bad news, that the individual on the other side of it who's wanting to leave is not grown up, not emotionally stable, not playing by the rules, not fair, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So there's an awful lot of reasons why a person that's on the receiving end of enlightenment might be resistant to it. They might be resistant to it consciously and deliberately, and understanding that this is putting them at a disadvantage, a manipulative disadvantage, that the person on the other side who has been subject to social pressure has now discovered the source of that social pressure and is in fact rebelling against that pressure and is now no longer under the manipulative came with the generally agreed upon social prescription. So that's one reason. And another reason is that they may feel, and it'd be more a Sam Harris unconscious situation, where they can feel that Niagara Falls is just, you know, a mile down the river, and it's time for us to swim the other direction. And so that also can be the case. In any event, the bringing of this information, if we're wise about it, has a degree of sensitivity to the fact that the other person on the other side of this may have an awful lot of conflict over their ability to absorb the new information. This is why it is that in my discussions of how to deal with our understanding of the direction that health needs to take with respect to diet, that what we bring is we bring an interest and an excitement, but a humility with this. So this is why my attitude is that these are some interesting ideas. Not sure the experts that are touting them are right about everything, but it looks like there's some promise. Okay. And, you know, it's worthy of an experiment for me to think about it. Rather than this is the way human beings ought to be, this is why you've got type 2 diabetes, and you damn well ought to do what it is that I say, and how dare you be ungrateful or argue with me over these details, and what I need to do if you push back at all is to read more textbooks or read more of the writings about this, memorize the science, and then beat you over the head with it. Now, the person on the other side of this is a complex mind with multiple agendas of their own. And the primary agenda isn't to simply walk away from their previous dietary patterns, thank you for telling them, and then bow down and give you never-ending credit for the fact that you brought them this information. Now, the fact that they might do so, okay, can lure you in to thinking that this is the way to go. Take out the hatchet. Any resistance should be met with aggression. And if you lose a battle because you weren't prepared for the argument, then lick your wounds, go back to the books, memorize more, come back ready to kill. Okay, don't do it. All of this new information, anything new and radical and threatening, the best way to manage this is from a position of humility, a position of understanding that the other person is a complex being with multiple agendas, and that also they have sometimes very good reasons for resisting the conclusions that you've come to. They have experiences and belief mechanisms. They, for example, just to give you one example, they may not be as smart as you are. And so it could be that they cannot actually integrate the logic as well as you've got it integrated, particularly on the fly. And it may turn out that they actually have they're less open, and therefore they have more weight that they give convention. So as a result, they're essentially a brain that's designed by nature to more consistently be following convention, because it's actually a safer decision-making strategy for them than it is to trust their own independent method. Okay, so this can get complicated enough that my prescription for how to handle this is to not essentially do a lot of arguing. If we're going to do anything, we're going to ask questions. Socrates, who is actually, from the accounts that I can tell, was actually a narcissistic bastard and loved to corner people and make life miserable for anybody that disagreed with him. However,
talk about a sacred cow.
Yeah, he left us, though, with an interesting strategy that's worth noting. And that's what we call the Socratic method, which is that he taught through essentially cross-examination, asking questions. And if we use a bit of that, not aggressively and relentlessly, but if we use the Socratic method, we can essentially move our way out of an argument, but move another mind into a position where they have to open up a little bit and they have to think about it. And so rather than by telling, we might ask. And by asking and not telling, we keep ourselves in any of these discussions in a position of power. Okay, so if you are checkmating and winning and demonstrating, you are actually you are asking the person on the other side to use every bit of their rhetorical instincts to try to look for anything in your argument that might not be 100% airtight. And so that's how we get arguments and we get defensiveness and we get issues. Instead, if we can shift any discussions with questions, we wind up putting ourselves in a position of power. Like, gee, you don't think that there might be a difference in sort of how men and women might look at things based on their reproductive goals? Because, after, you know, women can only have 8 or 10 kids and men can have 100. You know, and actually, men only have to just have an orgasm and a female has to take a kid to 9 months. So the minimum investments are quite a bit less. You don't think that might not have an impact? I mean, these people are saying it has a big impact, but you don't think it might be something? Okay. So by framing our arguments with some questions, we can potentially take a little bit out of the heat away, and the edge out of these discussions, and therefore potentially bring some enlightenment and improve our coalition's ability to think without causing undue stress and negative feelings for ourselves and others. But sometimes that won't work, including with my ex. All right. Good enough for one question. I suppose.
All right. We'll move on. I was going to say that when I first got into practice, I had done an internship at True North and saw all the incredible, remarkable things that reverse themselves after people get on a healthy diet and do some fasting.
Right.
And so when I would see my own personal patients in my practice, I was a little quick on the draw to tell them what the solution or all the problems were. And of course, that was met with a lot of argument, a lot of defensiveness of, oh, no, I already eat healthy. And it's like, and so it's constantly frustrating. And, it took a long time for me to really realize, and a lot of it had to do with listening to some of the on-air sessions that you did with people here on the show, that you get super detailed, ask a lot of questions, and then really gently introduce the idea that something's going on. And it's just, I just had a consult with a patient who I've been doing this with people, and just incredible how much more open they are when you ask every little bit and kind of allow them to fail.
Yes, absolutely. That's very good. Also, I would also say something else about this and about what you've been through. And this is I'm sure someone else has a name for this technique, somebody out there who's listening has probably read this in a book somewhere, and somebody else has formally, put this in some taxonomy of conversation. But I call it deficit desensitization. So there's a technique I use for, as a psychologist or in other circumstances like this, where I'm trying to educate somebody. This is what I try to do, is desensitize the fact that the other person's behavior or knowledge is at a deficit. And we're going to try to remove that deficit, but I want them to know that I'm not looking down. Okay, so this is tricky business. So, for example, if somebody comes to me about health, and I'll say, well, so do you smoke? No. Oh, you don't smoke? Oh. Okay, well, do you drink? Oh, not much. Oh. Oh, that's too bad. Yeah, I won't hold that against you. Okay. So now if I start out here, now what's going to happen is they're going to be willing to tell me about the things that they do. About all the crap they eat and the ice cream and everything, French fries, everything else outside. Because what I've done is I have essentially assumed that they were worse than they are, and it turns out that they have gone well above that. Okay, so now we can relax, and now they can tell me the truth, and then we're going to be fine. So I've desensitized them to the fact that otherwise they would be feeling that their behavior or record or et cetera is going to be at a deficit. So I actually discovered this little technique with criminals that I was trying to get the truth out of when I worked at Dallas, because it turns out that we didn't have national crime statistics and reporting at that time. And a lot of these people, I wanted to know what crimes they had committed in other locations, because I was trying to put together recommendations for judges, and I wanted to, the best predictor of the future is past performance. And so it's going to turn out that if you have any kind of algorithm that you're building to try to predict criminal behavior, it's important that the most important part of that algorithm is, what have they done in the past? And the problem is, you may not know what they've done in the past because you don't have records that go outside the state of Texas. So I would tell them, I would look at their record, and I'd say, oh, you did this, you did that. Oh, God, and they gave you 18 months for that or 2 years for that. Oh, geez, that all you did? For crying out loud, that's nothing. Yeah, okay. And then I'd say things like, I haven't really looked through your file here and looked at the national stats, your national record, but, you know, too much to look through now. But I'm going to have to look through it later. But what sorts of things have you ever been arrested for in other places? So I basically let them know that I did not think badly about all the things that I know they've been arrested for in Texas and what they're on probation for now. And now I'm going to look at the national stuff and I'm a pretty easygoing guy. So you can just go ahead and tell me, cause I'm going to see it anyway. I would watch these guys hesitate like, okay, I'm watching them run the cost benefit on whether or not they should come clean. Then I hear about, you know, the three rapes that took place in Oklahoma. Okay, this is how it is that we try to get information out of people. So it's deficit desensitization. Now, fortunately, I don't have to do this with criminals. I just do it with regular old people that I'm trying to alter the CB in their head for honesty. And so this is how it is that we would go about doing that. And we could do that. I do that in a variety of ways. I do that for people who may have some information that would be very useful for me to help them, but they have they're anxious about the status loss that's going to take place if they reveal that information. So if I sniff that out, I work around that defensiveness with a deficit desensitization strategy, and then everybody relaxes, and then I get the truth. So that's how we do it. All right.
Absolutely.
Fair enough. Okay.
All right. So our next question, you've answered this before, but mm-hmm. I liked the twist on the question, which is the following. Dr. Lyle, regarding our health, I've heard it said that our genes load the gun, but our environment pulls the trigger. In other words, it looks like we have the ability to beat our genes when it comes to things like developing heart disease or cancer. Why isn't the same true of our personality? If I'm born a disagreeable schmuck, why can't the environment in which I'm raised or live influence what personality characteristics I display? Can I ever beat my genes and be less of a disagreeable schmuck?
Oh, I want to meet this person. This person's got a great sense of humor. All right. First of all, the personality problems are not they're not diseases. So it's not something that goes wrong. So if you're disagreeable, it's not because something went wrong. It's because you're disagreeable. It turns out that you're not very smart. It isn't that something went wrong. It's just you're not very smart. The personality is more akin to tall and short, or more akin to skin color. So if you've got dark bronze skin, there's nothing wrong with your skin. If you've got light skin, there's nothing wrong with your skin. These are gene variances. Okay, if you're 6'4", there's nothing wrong with that. If you're 5'2", there's nothing wrong with that. So there can be inconveniences. So if you're a 5'2" male in this society, that's inconvenient. Or if you're a 6'4" female, it could be inconvenient. But there's nothing wrong with it. So let's begin there. So it's not anything close to the same thing as health issues. So health issues, the person has some genes that make it more likely that they're going to get heart disease. And then they eat a bunch of stuff that promotes heart disease, and they're more likely to get the problem than somebody that doesn't have the genes. But this is not, we're not talking about the development or epigenesis of disease here. We're simply talking about the emergence of personality characteristics. And the emergence of personality characteristics is, to the best of our knowledge, not subject to environmental influence. Or if it is subject to environmental influence, those influences are very small. And incidentally, they do not appear to be systematic. In other words, nobody knows what you can do to make a person more open, or make them more, extroverted, or make them more conscientious. They just are what they are. So, if you are a disagreeable schmuck, the question is, can you outthink your genes? And the answer would be probably on occasion you can, the not reflexively, not over the 100,000 interactions that you'll have in your life, that you will bring to it a disagreeable mindset that you can't help. But there may be moments that are important that you can have a red flag up in your brain and do things against the way your genetic code would be telling you to do them. An example would be, for example, don't sue. Particularly, don't sue the psychologist, because you went to marriage therapy and your spouse got some support from this, you know, SOB psychologist who said, you know what, doesn't sound like you're very happy. Maybe you should think about taking an experiment and leaving for a little while and see what happens. And your spouse lightens up and then leaves you, and then you feel like suing this guy. It happens to be a guy, by the way, and he lives in California. Don't sue him.
He likes to run experiments.
All right. So with your friends, you know, if you find yourself in a situation with a good friend who, if you got a good friend and you're disagreeable, you should understand that there's probably the word saint painted on their forehead. You just got to look at it from the right angle. So you find yourself locked in a pissing match with your good friend who's a saint, at which point you should realize, you know what, I'm disagreeable. A good strategy is for me to go more than halfway. Okay? It's a good strategy for all of us to have in our back pocket, but particularly if you're disagreeable. You ought to grit your teeth when the going gets tough and you're about to try to ramrod your position through a friendship that's valuable. Back up and go more than halfway. Okay. Thirdly, I would say that if you're in an argument, which is essentially, this is a more specific prescription for what I just talked about, of go more than halfway. If you're in trouble in an argument with your boss, your coworker, the IRS agent, you know, remember, give esteem in an argument. The person on the other side of an argument is arguing with you because they are feeling like you are not giving them enough esteem. If you are a disagreeable person, it's very likely that it's quite possible their feelings about this are based on some legitimate realities. And so when you're if there are costs associated with this argument, it's a good move for you to actually back up and give them some esteem, i.e. go more than halfway. Try to go against your instincts. Now, people listening to me might say, come on, you've said that, you know, personality is personality, instincts are instincts, et cetera, et cetera. You cannot beat instincts as a chronic issue, but you can beat them periodically with great focus. Let me give you a fantastic example. I don't know how fantastic it is, but it's a perfect example. The genes have built the male brain to be constantly looking at attractive females and thinking about having sex with them. This is, you know, can be inconvenient. It can be annoying to partners, et cetera, et cetera. The fact is, we will not change that fact, and there's no possible way you can change that. That's off the table. Okay? However, here's something that you can change. You can change the desire if you're about to have sex with somebody you're attracted to. You can put on a bloody condom. That you can do. So you can momentarily halt what the genes want you to do and put in place a barrier between you and an outcome you don't want to see. That is possible. Okay? That's how it is that we can beat the genes. This is what I call wisdom forks. This is about when it's okay to follow the genes, and then when we can become aware of when it's not okay to follow the genes. If you are a disagreeable person and you have listened to this and you understand that disagreeable chip is in your DNA, that's just how you're built, then one of the things that you can do is you can learn, well, watch out for times when there are possibly considerable expenses on the other side of you giving your DNA its head, and don't do it. Don't sue. Don't lose your friends, and be careful in an argument to give the other person esteem. These would be places where you can periodically puncture the potential disaster of a balloon that you are blowing up behind having DNA that is essentially inconveniently disagreeable.
Wow, fantastic.
All right.
We have time for one quick one from a listener. She wants
to
know.
Give it a shot.
Okay, so Dr. Lai, this listener just messaged me and was really curious about this. She just reconnected with a very close friend, and they haven't spoken for years. And now, as they've gone closer, she's helping him with something. But he's telling her, "Well, are you ready for the upcoming, financial crisis? Are you ready about this and all these worst case scenarios that he's all worried about?"
Mm-hmm. Right.
I suggested to her that she reads How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World, but we wanted to hear from you about this issue.
Oh, about because he's kind of bombarding her, and she feels sort of bombarded by his
burning
sort of
issues.
There's a crisis and a burning. There's burning issues. Okay.
Yeah.
So she's feeling pressure behind the burning issue. In other words, this guy needs to understand that he's in a burning issue trap. And so that's part of what's going on. What would I say? I would say I would probably give the person a little bit of status with respect to this. For example, I'm just trying to think how I would do this. I would say, it's interesting what you're saying. There's probably something to it. But I'm a bit of a flake, and I'm just not going to worry that much about it. So this is what I call going upside down. So this is how we are going to take status away from ourselves, and in doing so, not follow their prescription and signal to them that what the great information that they are trying to bring to the table to get status is something that we're not going to be following and that we're not going to bite on. But the reason we're going to do this is because we've got some essentially suboptimal sort of personality deficits. Now, when we do this, their brains are sophisticated enough to pick up that there may be a little bit of truth in what we're saying, but actually we're just simply not valuing their message that much. And they will be mildly frustrated, but they won't be, but we will not be sending them a signal to educate them when they are so determined to educate us. So we will display some degree of mild openness towards what it is that they're saying, but we're not going to be taking any action and getting feverish. We're not drinking their Kool-Aid. Why? Because we're a little bit of a flake. Okay. So that's off the top of my head. That's actually how I would personally handle that. And this goes under the line of where we started this tonight was, what do they call that? Radical honesty or something like this. And I'm not going to do that. I'm going to be pretty slick about this. Because really what this person is needing is they're needing esteem from me. And what they really need, what we need to have is this relationship sort of reconnect and us analyze whether or not how much we value each other as people. And we want a process to sort of develop. And in this process, we want this relationship to have some time and some leisure and some interaction for us to find out how much we value each other. And so this is a way for me to give the person feedback that says, I'm not going to argue with you and I'm not going to join your band. I like you and I'm listening, but please don't be offended when I don't grab my pitchfork and start hunting for communists, behind my garbage can, you know, and in my garage. Okay, I'm just not going to do it. So I hear you, and I understand the great red threat. And, you know, it's kind of interesting what you're saying. And you've certainly done a lot of research, and that's pretty cool. But please recognize that although I find it interesting, I'm not convinced enough to worry. And one of the reasons I'm not worrying is probably because I'm a little bit of a flake. Okay. So we let that put that friend, that rebutting friendship in a position to give us some time to analyze who the person is while we find other ways to signal to them that we value them. And then we let the whole process emerge and then find out what the whole relationship's worth. If it turns out that there's some survivalist in that case that just won't let this go, and they're like a paranoid dog with a bone, then we may find that we have to pull away anyway. Okay, so, but we can certainly give them a little bit of a soft touch while we see if a relationship can develop without them needing to bring that as the ace that they lead in this card game. Okay?
Fantastic. Kyle, as always.
All right.
Wonderful pleasure.
Very good. Pleasure. Thanks for having me again, Nate. Great as always. And, you know, we'll see people soon.
Absolutely. Have a good night, everybody. Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.